Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I'm talking with Stephen Johnston. He is one of the producers of a movie called Some Kind of Different as Me, which is a true story based on the book of the same name. And the DVD and Blu-ray has been released just this last week. Stephen, welcome to Life Quest.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Tell our listeners some things about yourself and how you got involved with this particular project.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, actually, how I got involved. I was a huge fan of this book. It was a very powerful story that I'd read. My wife had given me the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it really stuck with me. And then through a strange set of circumstances, I ended up meeting the author and a group that he had pulled together to help get the movie on the big screen, or get the story on the big screen. And as I learned more and more about that opportunity, I became more invested in the project. And I was actually not a traditional filmmaker when I took on this role 4 years ago. It was a role where I felt I was called to help get this powerful story told. And so I originally just got into the project to help them and to help raise the capital and help make a really great movie about this New York Times bestselling book and the story that was behind it. But as I got involved, it ended up sucking me in, and I ended up working on it every day for, the past 4 years. So it's been an incredible experience, one that has really, changed my life, obviously, but also I think inspired others to do great things.
Now it's a Paramount Pictures production, and it's got some serious names in it as actors.
Yeah, absolutely. Paramount was obviously one of the best, movie companies in the world, so it was an honor to be able to partner with them on this project. But the biggest thing for us when we got involved in this project, and particularly when I got involved, and they were looking to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal was to make a movie that would stand the test of time. And we knew we had it. We needed to invest in, serious actors and talent. And we also, really needed to get the best Hollywood could offer because we felt like this story deserved it. And so that's what we did. So we raised a lot of money for the film. We invested heavily in getting a world-class crew. And then we went out and found, the absolute best people we possibly could to play the roles of Ron and Debbie Hall and Denver Moore and Ron's father. And so, it's a first-class production. And like I said, I think it's a movie that will stand the test of time and people will watch over and over again for years to come.
Yeah, I looked at it and I'm thinking, wow, it's Renee Zellweger and Greg Kinnear and John Voight, names that we have seen for a long time. They seem to be drawn to the movie or to the project as it was presented to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it. Each person has a different story about why they chose to, be a part of this project, and so it's really amazing to hear their personal stories about what made them say, hey, I want to be a part of this and I want to, play this role. But, Renee in particular, had really not, she had been off the scene for, 5 or 6 years.
Yes.
And not made a movie. And, for her, I know because she shared the story, she felt like, the movie was not just about a movie. It was about making a difference. And,
mm-hmm.
And one of the things that really moved her was our desire to transform or help transform the community where we actually filmed the movie, which was in Jackson, Mississippi. And so she was really drawn to the fact that not only were we going to make a movie here, but we were going to leave the city a better place by investing in the community center where we, filmed the film, or we filmed a large portion of the film because it was the homeless mission in Fort Worth, Texas.
Yeah.
But we made it a better place when we left it. We ended up investing heavily in that, and it's really, even to this day, is serving that community in a great way. And so, for her, I think it was more about a bigger picture opportunity than it was, just about being playing a great role in a movie.
Stephen, can you give our listeners a synopsis of the story?
Yeah, absolutely. So the story, and once again, I want to reiterate, it's a true story. And so this really happened, and it's about a homeless guy named Denver Moore and his relationship with a couple from Fort Worth, Texas. And it's the most unlikely encounters one could have. And basically, Denver Moore, the homeless man, he grew up with nothing. He was not educated. He grew up on a sharecropper's plantation in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. He left at the age of 18. He ended up spending time in Angola prison and traveling the country on a train, and ended up ultimately in the streets of Fort Worth, Texas, 40 or 50 years later. And that's where he lived as one of the most dangerous, violent homeless men in America, certainly in Fort Worth, Texas. And one day he busted into a homeless mission, and it just so happened that Ron and Debbie Hall were there. And Debbie Hall was she was serving there. She was very philanthropic as a person, and you know, she had a dream about a man who would ultimately save the city of Fort Worth. And when he bust through the mission, she told her husband Ron, he says, "Hey, that's the man of my dreams, and wow, that's the guy I dreamed about." And so the story is about their relationship and their friendship, and how ultimately their lives are changed because of who Denver Moore was. And it's just a powerful story on friendship, on love, on faith, on hope, and most importantly, probably on forgiveness.
And it comes across very realistic, doesn't it? It's a real story. The actors portray them in such a realistic way, and that kind of truth, and of course, it's based on a true story, as you said, but sometimes it always doesn't transfer to the screen that way, but it did this time.
Well, I think so, and I think the director was very intentional about it, and the screenwriters, they knew that the story had such a huge following. The one thing that we couldn't do was produce a movie that the book lovers didn't like,
yeah,
right? And so, and I will tell you, the people who love the book have really loved the film. And so they realized we couldn't get every story that's in the 230-page book,
sure,
on the screen, but they do love the quality of the film and the fact that the heart of the story, you know, we tried to stick with it. But, you know, I told Greg Kinnear, he was just such the perfect role for Ron Hall. And you know, I told him one day, I said, "Greg, you know, you're a better Ron Hall than Ron Hall is."
Very good. That's excellent. I wanted to ask you, you said at the beginning that, you know, you're not necessarily a film person or certainly a Hollywood movie person, but how did this experience affect you?
Yeah, well, you know, it's obviously, it's changed my life forever, right? I mean, this is such a, you know, the one thing about film is it's permanent. And so, you know, you can constantly go back and, you know, see, you know, and remember where you were during certain times in your life. But mm-hmm. what's really important about this as it relates to me as an individual, if you would have asked me on April the 30th, 2014, I was an investment banker by trade, and I ultimately ran a very successful technology company, and I sold it in 2012. And mm-hmm. In 2014, I had no idea what I was going to do next in my life. And, you know, I felt like I wanted to do something that was meaningful, but I really just didn't know what it was. And then the next day, I ended up meeting Ron Hall and the people, the director and screenwriters and my producing partner. And on that day, I said, you know, this is how I'm going to spend the next few years of my life helping the story be told. And so, you know, it's not something that I entered into lightly. And as I said, I didn't really know a lot about what I was getting into, to be honest with you. And I certainly didn't know that I would work every single day for for 4 years on this story. But what happened is you just realize the importance and significance of the story that's in this movie. And it deserved everything I could give it. And so, you know, my goal was to make a film that would inspire other people to do great things, and I think we've accomplished that.
Often we hear a lot of negativity about the industry, the film industry, especially large ones like this. You sound like you connected with some very real people, both well-known and maybe not so much, in the industry.
Yes, you know, absolutely, and, you know, many of them, you know, I talk to on a weekly basis or daily basis, even today. You know, I will tell you, you know, Hollywood and the business of making movies, it's a very tough business. And I probably didn't realize how tough it was when we started this journey. But I believe when you start something, you finish it. And you know, we had our own ups and downs and our mm-hmm. hurdles along the way. And truthfully, you know, this is a story that has such a positive message. I mean, I felt we got attacked at times, because we were trying to do something that was so positive and yeah. uplifting. And so I don't discount how difficult the environment is. What everybody says is absolutely true. But with that being said, the cast and crew and the actors and, you know, the people that are associated with, you know, at least our film, were some of the best people I've ever met in my life. Mm-hmm. And I consider all of them to be just great friends today. And I just feel very blessed to have, you know, met people that, you know, 4 years ago, I didn't even know they existed. Right. And so now today, there's such a big part of my life and my family's life. It's really been an amazing experience.
So you had this one career before, you know, 2012 or 14, and then you got involved in this, but, you know, you playing golf all day, or what's happening with you?
No, man. I will tell you that I am, you know, involved in another film project. That's a great project that I got involved with the people I met in this film. And I think that's the way it works sometimes.
Sure.
We're telling the Cesar Millan story, the dog whisperer story.
Oh, yes.
And he has such a great life story and how he came into America and you know, as an immigrant, and it really is an illegal immigrant. And he's just a really awesome person that has really impacted a lot of people. And so I am working on that in a little bit different capacity than my role was same kind of different as me. But it is a project that I'm involved with. You know, it's I'm also, you know, back to the grindstone and the other things that people would say, oh, yeah, that's what you really do for a living. So I'm still trying to figure it out like everybody else. But, you know, I can honestly say that, you know, being a part of this movie experience, you know, really shaped me and helped me grow as a person. And so I know I'm a better person because of the experiences we went through.
Where can our listeners get a copy of this DVD or Blu-ray?
Yeah, so it's for sale, certainly in Walmart and Target. You know, that's probably the best place. I'm sure that, you know, you can also order them online and Amazon and other places, but it would be in all your typical, you know, retailers. But Walmart and Target both have been very supportive, and they're mm-hmm. excited about the film, and it, you know, are really doing great at getting it out there and marketing it and showing it to people, because, you know, it wasn't in the theater for as long as obviously I would have liked it. And
yes,
we're all busy people, and it's a competitive market. But I can guarantee the viewers is that, you know, when they watch this film, they will change as a person, mm-hmm. and it will inspire them in one way or the other. And I know the world will be a better place the more people that watch this movie. And so, and I also want to say that, you know, my favorite part of the movie is when it's over, 20 seconds, I don't know if you stayed and saw this, but when the credits roll, there's a moment there with the real Denver Moore. And it just really brings the whole story full circle, and you see the person that the movie was really about. And it's just such a touching moment. I just want to encourage people to be still and watch the movie through the credits, because it's a powerful moment.
I'm talking with Stephen Johnson. He's a producer for the movie Same Kind of Different as Me, Paramount Pictures production. Stephen, I hope that with your next project, you can keep in touch with us here at LifeQuest.
Well, thank you. I would certainly love to do that. I appreciate you talking about the movie, and appreciate all that you do on radio. So thank you.
I'll be back in just a moment. Today we welcome to LifeQuest Don Jacobson. He's been a church administrator, an author, a parent, a missionary in Asia. Thank you for being with us today, Don.
Thank you, Dwight. And a great grandfather. Don't forget that one.
Come You're on. So much older than I thought. Among other things, Don Jacobson has written a book called Rare Kids, Well Done. Parenting kids that are respectful, responsible, and obedient. I'm glad you have successful answers to all of my questions. What can be done? Everybody from Plato on has complained about young people and teenagers. And
yeah, I speak a fair amount around to parent groups, Dwight, and it seems to me like one of the common comments is, I want my family back. I want my kids back. It just seems like my kids have taken off. They're doing their own thing. I can't do anything with them. If I tell them something, they just roll their eyes.
And, yes. And say whatever.
Walk away and say whatever. That's the classic. Yeah. So I have a lot of fun talking to parents because, you know, God designed this whole family thing in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some principles in his word that really take the bite out of raising kids. It doesn't have to be 17 years of anguish.
I think I'm a better parent now than I was several decades ago.
Oh, absolutely. In his book, I say, these are some of the things I wish I had known before I know what I know.
Mm-hmm. You know what else I noticed, Don? I will talk to my oldest girl, who's 37 years old. And I will.
Now, you're older than I thought you were.
Yeah, I know. And I apologize for some of the disciplinary action or the sermons I gave her or something like that. And she said to me recently, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't remember that.
Mm.
The things that I thought were so kind of negative, she didn't particularly feel they were.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
It is.
You know, we learn to think psychologically about our kids.
Okay.
Our kids do something wrong and we say, now I wonder what I did that made him react like that.
Took away his all-day sucker when he was four.
Yeah, right. And that, you know, that's caused this psychological issue with his kid. But the issue is not why did Johnny do what he did, but what should we do about what Johnny did? Because parenting is about leadership. It's not, there's no magic bullet. There's no 1, 2, 3 magic. It's not about just having to say exactly the right words. It's about leadership. Kids need leadership. Leadership means that I have a vision of what, mm-hmm. and I say that in the proper sense of the word. I'm looking ahead. I like to ask parents when I'm talking to them, if you were to look to the time when your kids will be 25,
all right,
what are the characteristics you'd like to see in them? Let me just hear from you. So they talk to me about that, and they'll say, well, I want him to be honest. I want him to be generous. I want him to be kind. And they'll go through this whole litany of things. And then I'll say, okay, tell me the things that you're struggling with the most right now in your parenting. And they'll say, well, I can't get him up in the morning, or I can't get him to brush his teeth every day, or I can't get him to do his homework.
Right.
He leaves his bike out in the rain. And so I ask them to look at where they're investing their emotional energies today, and are they investing that where they want the kids to be in a way that's going to help where their kids will be in 25 years or when they're 25 years old?
Yeah. My 12-year-old, I'm pretty sure, will be a great attorney. She loves to argue. And you're suggesting that there are reasons not to enter into that type of dialogue with your daughter.
Yeah, absolutely. Arguing levels the playing field. Arguing happens between equals.
Yes.
But as a parent, you are not your daughter's equal. You are the leader in the family. And very often I'll have people say, raise their hand, say, you know, my son, my daughter is very argumentative. I'll ask the group, tell me, how many of you have argumentative kids? Everybody in the room raises their hands. I mean, this is a common plague among kids. But here's the issue. Our kids are not argumentative. It's simply that we set up the conditions under which they push back.
Okay.
So parenting then as a leader, speak once, say it once, make sure it's clear. Don't be lengthy with it, but just give the direction, turn around and walk away. And there's nothing to argue with there. I mean, you can't argue with somebody who won't argue with you.
Yeah.
So they argue because I set it up so they will. And so they ask why. And so I go into all this reason, this logical reason, you know. But as a leader, my role is not to explain why. It's to simply make decisions on the basis of what I see coming when they're 25.
In your book, you like the word coach.
Yeah.
How does that apply here?
I think there's some great nuances in that word because a coach sees the best in every player. A good coach doesn't spend his life lamenting the fact that they lost a game, but looks to the next game. Coach can see strengths in a player that the player doesn't see. And a coach can be forceful. He can sit a player down for a quarter and say, you know, you need to sit here and think about this for a while. So I think there's some wonderful parallels between the role of a coach and the role of a parent. Both involve leadership. There are two ingredients in parenting kids, love and leadership. And without either of those, it's going to be a stormy walk.
You have a quote in here from the football great Joe Namath.
Yeah.
Where he said, until I was 13, I thought my name was Shut Up.
One of the things that I discover that is just really essential in a relationship between parents and kids is mutual respect. You don't yell shut up to somebody whom you deeply respect.
Yes.
But respect is mutual. The people that I deeply respect are more apt to have respect for me.
Mm-hmm.
I expect my kids to respect my authority, to expect my responsibilities, to do what they're told. But in order for me to make sure that they have a reason to do that, I have to be respectful to them. And not yell shut up, not call them names, not put them down, not belittle them. Affirm them when I can.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not take the leadership part out of my role as a parent, as a father.
We're really having to redefine in some of our minds leadership.
Absolutely, absolutely. It does not help kids become what they will want to become and what parents want them to become to abdicate leadership and just let them turn them loose, let them on their own, you know, hands off kind of parenting where they can do anything they want to. And the parents just don't seem to care, or at least don't put forth the energy to do anything about it. But parents are, first of all, leaders in their homes.
You present, Don, here, a number of tools a parent can use in parenting. Some of it is just questions about right and wrong. You even use one called feed them the right stuff. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think that it has come upon us over a couple of generations, but today's kids, the minds of today's kids are being just overloaded with, for instance, television. And there are things, there are issues here with television besides content, but
mm-hmm.
the time kids are 12 and up, content becomes the issue.
Right.
Before that, it's a matter of the development of the child. It's a physical thing. In children's programming, for instance, which seems so inert and so
yes.
inconsequential. A lot of people use them for babysitters.
Right.
You know, just park your kid there and he won't cry for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, the average child's television program, the scene changes
mm-hmm.
every 3.5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Different character, different action, different set, different activity, whatever. And the thing that does is in the dendrite section of the brain. I don't want to get hyper-technical here
mm-hmm.
because I'm the wrong kind of doctor to do that anyway. But in the dendrite section of the brain, we are training that brain to respond, to be stimulated by and respond to need that kind of short bursts of hyper-stimulation. So the kid gets to school at the age of 6 or 7, and the teacher doesn't teach like that.
Yes.
So the kid's behavior is irascible. The teacher has a hard time with them. And then what often happens is that they come home with a diagnosis of ADD or ADHD or ODD or one of those
alphabets.
New alphabets. And they want to give them a pill. When often, one of the first things, when parents come and say, describe a character trait like this that
mm-hmm.
they're unhappy with, I ask two questions usually. One is, how much television is the youngster being subjected to? And second, does he or she have chores? Because chores, early chores, begin to build responsibility, begin to help people's kids see that they're not just freeloaders. They're not just there to get what they can get out of the relationship at home, but they're members of the family. They're part of the people who carry the load. 3 years old, when a child is 3 years old, they should be learning to make their own bed, take some help with from mom or dad to begin with. But that's not too early for a youngster to start learning responsibility, helping to set the table, put the dishes on the table or put the dishes in the sink after dinner, put the dirty clothes where they're supposed to be. So I ask those two questions, and very often I discover that Here's a youngster who's been subjected to extended time in front of the television tube. Primarily television is the culprit there rather than other kinds of screens.
Yes.
And are you beginning to give them responsibilities so that they see themselves as load-carrying members of the family, part of that team, mm-hmm. team family, rather than just freeloaders and everybody's going to wait on me the rest of my life?
My name is Dwight Lainhoff. This program comes to you from studios in the Meadowglade Church, Battleground, Washington.